Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and today our topic is completely different from the normal one on this show, but I think touches all of us at some time or another. If you've experienced the loss of a loved one, the process of grieving and moving on can be enormously difficult. I know. I've recently lost my mom, and I'm still dealing with the ramifications of that. My guest today has written a book about this that I think can be helpful to people out there in similar situations. It's really a good book. He's got a familiar name, but he took a unique type of journey of self-discovery and healing after the loss of his father, who you will know the name when you hear my guest. He's Luke Russert. And the book is called Look For Me There, Grieving My Father, Finding Myself. Luke, thanks a lot for taking the time today. And by the way, folks, this book just came out in paperback.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin. I appreciate it. It's nice to be here.
It's, you know, I remember when your dad passed, he was an iconic journalist with NBC, host of Meet the Press. He's probably the best interviewer I've ever seen. I remember when that happened, and I recall your career right afterwards seemed to be taking off, but I do remember when you kind of disappeared. You had quite the career set before you, and you just decided to take a path. What led to all that?
Yeah, well, it was an interesting journey, which I document in the book. But, you know, my father passed in 2008 at the young age of 58, and I was 22 at the time. And I gave a eulogy that was broadcast around the country, really a eulogy which at the time when I wrote it, I never knew or even anticipated the magnitude of it, mainly because I think at that time, right after his passing, I was in a different stratosphere. I was just sort of trying to get by and not necessarily aware of everything that was happening or the magnitude of it. So I wrote that eulogy, and it landed with a lot of people. And I had some folks in the TV world that said, you know, you are very well spoken for a young man. You got a great name. Would you be interested in making this a career? And I'd grown up around journalism my entire life. My mom is a journalist too. She's a writer for Vanity Fair. So it was always something I was comfortable with. I didn't necessarily know I was going to go in that path, but I sort of saw, okay, here's an opportunity. You'd be foolish not to take it. I wasn't naive. I knew there'd be charges of nepotism. I knew that I'd really have to work hard to prove myself. But it was also a place of comfort to a degree, because I knew a lot of the people who had worked with my father. I grew up around, you know, gaffer's tape and studios and being on the road and things like that. And I also felt to some degree I brought people warmth and comfort who were also grieving, not only in NBC, but around the country. So I did that for about 8 years, and I worked on Capitol Hill and really grew to love the grind of politics. I thought it was fascinating. It was almost like getting a master's degree in American politics covering Capitol Hill for NBC News. But I reached a point around 30 years old when I thought that was old. It's not. Not now, as I'm 38. But I had got to a point where I began to sort of question whether, was this really me, or was I doing this as a legacy preservation? Was I doing this to make my father proud? Was I doing this because I felt I had to? And did I really want to? And it was a question I struggled with. And lo and behold, I had a chance encounter with House Speaker John Boehner. And John Boehner is someone who I had covered rather aggressively, but we got along. And he said to me, he goes, I want to see you in my office. And I thought he was upset about coverage. As you know, sometimes politicians will say not nice things to you because they didn't like how something came out in a report.
Yes.
And he called me into his office and he asked a very simple question. He goes, what are you doing here? I said, well, you're the Speaker of the House. You invited me into your office. I go, of course I'm going to come. He goes, no, what are you doing here on Capitol Hill? You've been here for 8 years. You walk around like you own the place. You know everybody. You've had a lot of success, but you know, I've seen people that have been here 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. It's a very transactional place, and you're kind of a creature of Washington. You never really get outside and see how the world works and see how people interact. And you might be well served to go see that or learn a different skill. And it hit me hard because it had reinforced a lot of feelings that were going on internally. And when someone of Speaker Boehner's stature, who was literally on top of the hill, says the view is not that bright, you should reevaluate some of your priorities. I then took that message and I said, okay, you know what? I need to figure out who I am beyond my name, beyond this bubble I grew up in Washington, and just walk away from this for a little bit. Go travel, go see the world, go do something different. And when I started that journey, it was only going to be 6 months to a year, and it ended up being over 3 years to 70 countries. And I was a little lost on the way, but I ended up being found. And what the story ties back to is that I was doing two things on that journey. One, I was searching for something. So who am I independent of the last name, of that identity? Who am I truly? But then I was also running away from something, and that was grief. And I had never really processed the grief, because when I was 22, if I had processed the grief, it really would have, I would have had to admit that dad was gone. I would have had to confront that in a way which I was never comfortable. It was much easier to store and ignore. It was much easier just to throw myself into work, throw myself into all sorts of other things and not have to really acknowledge the magnitude and the burden of that passing. So that's what the book is about, and the journey along the way. But I think what I've been so touched by, you know, now it's been out almost a year, and I wrote a new afterword for the paperback, is how grief can affect you in so many different ways. And there's no set time. There's no set manner. It can come in the most random occurrences and just leaves you with this heavy weight. And it takes a long time to figure that out. I'm happy I did, but had I not removed myself from the sort of hamster wheel of life, I don't think it ever would have happened.
It can be enormously crippling at times too. And you're right. Yeah. I've experienced that. Just a song comes on the radio and it's like, yeah. Whoa, you know, and
you get transported back. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. And it's just like something just throwing off your whole day, but you've got to learn to cope. You've got to learn to deal with it. And that's what this book is about. Explain to our listeners real quick the title, which I think is interesting in itself.
Oh, so when you write a book, the publishers put so much pressure on you for a title. And it was an exercise that I wasn't really looking forward to. And I locked myself in my office with a legal pad and I kept writing things out. And I was trying to think about, all right, what is this book really about? And I said, I'm looking for something. And then it came to me, I go, oh my gosh. So when I was a young boy, my father used to take me to baseball games at Oriole Park at Camden Yards. And this was in the pre-cell phone era. So we used landmarks. And there was we were in this very crowded concourse and this crush of people came and he was holding my hand and we got separated. And I fell back about 8 to 10 yards behind him. He never lost sight of me, but it was just sort of a wave of people moving. And he kept his eyes on me and he came back. And he put his arm over my shoulder and he said, hey, if we're ever separated, just look for me there. And he pointed at a hot dog stand with a big bird on it. That was the landmark. But he used to say that to me. So when I was traveling back from college, picking up the airport, he'd say, hey, look for me there. After a concert, look for me there. And it just hit. And as soon as I had it, I went on Google. I was like, please let no one else have this. I hope there's not some random rock band in Idaho or something that had this. And no one had it. And I bought the website right away. And I called my publisher. I said, there it is. And it's I'm very proud of the title. That's just something that really that came to. And I like to think that he had a hand in that because I was very anxious about it beforehand. And it was actually relatively easy once I got that legal pad out, just like he used to do, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I One of the interesting aspects of your story is your relationship with your mom. And as we talked about, your mom was a very distinguished journalist in her own right. But your dad, of course, was more famous. He was on TV. She's more of a print journalist. But talk a little bit about that, how the relationship there. And I think other people have dealt with this as well.
Yeah. You know, when one parent passes on, your relationship with the remaining one changes. It doesn't matter what that relationship was like before. There is change to be had. And in my case, as I write, I was way closer to my dad growing up. We had that male bond. We bonded over sports, and he was my best friend. And my mom was great to me, but it was a different type of relationship. And the way I describe it in the book is she was kind of that coach that was more the disciplinarian, which is, you know, you brought home a B+. Why wasn't it an A-? You scored 12 points. You should have scored 15 because you could have hit the open three. Like, you could have done better. Whereas my dad was more of the coach of like, hey, you know, you did a good job, but you're better than that. You can do better. And here's how we're going to make that happen. There's merit to both ways of coaching, by the way, as I've aged, I see. But what was interesting is that once I traveled with my mother for the first time, and I was 31 years old before I ever traveled with her one-on-one. And I had gone to countless games and conventions with my father, but it was 31 years old, my first time I ever traveled one-on-one with my mom. And she was a Peace Corps volunteer in Colombia in the 60s when she was a young woman. And she took that job on because when she graduated from college, really the only opportunities available to her were to be a stewardess or a secretary or a teacher. And she really wanted to do something else and have more of a sense of independence. So she joined the Peace Corps and built schools in Colombia. And she had always said to me, putting herself in those uncomfortable situations allowed her to see who she really was for herself and allowed her to really lean into everything she'd learned and also to be strong and to be tough and to make the most out of a situation. And so when I traveled with her and we went to some of these countries in Latin America, like Paraguay and Uruguay and Argentina, and I saw how fearless she was, and I saw how she would just speak truth to power, and she would go into these indigenous markets and all sorts of these things. And I kind of sometimes was like, oh, are we really going there? Are we really going to just walk out in the middle of the street like that and stop traffic? And it was in that trip with her that I began to realize something that's very important that I think we all come to at some point, which is that, you know, who was our mom independent of the role of mom? Who was she as Maureen at one point? And I got to know Maureen on that trip. And once I got to know Maureen and saw how she had always seen all these obstacles in her way that she had to bulldoze through because she was a young woman at a time when it was very hard to get recognition. And then as a journalist in the 70s at Newsweek, having to deal with a very male-dominated culture, I then saw, okay, this is why you were so hard on me, because you were trying to put forward some of that wisdom that life isn't easy. You're too coddled. You have to learn how to struggle through adversity, and you have to have that grind. And it made our relationship a lot better because I began to understand the totality of my childhood in a way that I never would have been able to had I not taken that trip with her.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson. And I'm really delighted to have as my guest today, Luke Russer, who is the author of a book that just came out in paperback. I highly recommend. Look for me there, Grieving My Father, Finding Myself. This is a little different topic than what we've had here recently, but I think it's worthwhile for our listeners because of the lessons that Luke offers in this book that we can all learn from. The trips you go on are really interesting. There's no way we're going to be able to cover it, so I recommend folks get the book and read. But I've got to pick some things out that I thought were particularly interesting. You did most of this alone. You went with your mom to some places, but you did most of this alone. And this kind of was risky at times. In fact, you had an interesting experience in one of the African countries that underwent a change in government.
Yeah, so a lot of the travel was solo, and the reason for that was because I really wanted to see what I was made of, and I wanted to be able to go to places and really sort of jump into the culture and not use the safety net of having a friend, sort of strip you down, communicate. You don't know the language. You don't know the people. All right, how are you going to get by? You have your trusty Google machine though on your phone, so that helps out a lot. But I was in Zimbabwe, And I went to go see Victoria Falls, which is a beautiful place. And lo and behold, a coup unfolded in the country of Zimbabwe. And of course, that's very scary because you have no idea what's going on. And thankfully, Zimbabwe speaks English, so I could tune in to TV and see these generals barking on air and be like, okay. But a friend of mine was in the capital called Harare, and I was set to go visit him and his wife. He was working there, and he said, yeah, I wouldn't come here. And I go, well, what do you think I'd do? He goes, you should probably get out of the country if you can. I said, okay. And so I go through flights and I call the airport. I'm saying, are you guys open? They're like, we're open right now. We don't know how late we'll be open, but there are some flights coming and going. So I scrambled, and there is this driver who I had the day before, who was a very nice young man. And I said, hey, can we get to the airport? He goes, well, I don't know. I think they closed down the road, but I my cousin works over there. Let me just try it. And we get in the car, we go down the highway, and there's these guys with big guns. And he just says to me, he goes, get in the front, get in the front. I said, okay. And so we get in the front, and he just says to them in a sort of local dialect, I'm driving this diplomat. And they go, okay. And so I got to the airport and I got out. And thankfully, it wasn't a violent coup, which was good. But at that time, we didn't know. So it was the beginning stages of it. And then thankfully, a few days went by and tension subdued. But that was one of those moments where when you're grateful for, you know, your time in the United States with relative safety, but also just when you're in a location and nobody knows who's in charge, that's something that you remember for a very long time, for sure, for sure.
You talk in several parts of the book about how you notice how the United States is an exporter of culture, bringing us all kind of closer together. And one of the more funny parts, there's several funny parts of this book, but made me laugh out loud, involved the song Achy Breaky Heart. You've got to share that.
So, yeah, I was in Cambodia, and I was going there to see Angkor Wat. And there's a town called Siem Reap. And I'm walking down the street, and I hear Achy Breaky Heart. I said, wait, Billy Ray Cyrus in Cambodia? And for whatever reason, that song is incredibly popular in Cambodia. And what was wild was going into the place where it was this sort of karaoke bar, but it was a real band who was playing. And you had Cambodians singing, but then there were Koreans there, and there were Japanese there, and there were Chinese there. So all these different Asian cultures, and they're all singing Achy Breaky Heart. And so you kind of think about that. Billy Ray Cyrus's words and music can get into four unique Asian cultures, and it's a hit and has everybody dancing. And that to me was it was illuminating, because you always know about America's military prowess and economic prowess. But I think something that folks don't realize is that no matter whatever happens to our country, what we export through our film, television, and music lives forever and has completely been accepted and enjoyed by billions of people.
Maybe the president needs to enlist Billy Ray Cyrus for some diplomatic efforts right? over there.
Indeed.
Faith plays a strong role in your family, and you talk about it openly in this book. I thought it was interesting that you kind of felt at the end of your journeys kind of called to the Holy Land. Talk about that and your experience there, and also obviously you felt your father's presence there as well.
Yeah. So faith is something that I've always embraced since a young age. I remember my first real experience with it is I was in the church pews. I was a young kid. We were at Sunday Mass. My father's Irish Catholic, my mom Italian Catholic, so Catholic family. And I would be playing with my Matchbox cars. And I remember I asked my dad one time, I said, you know, why do we have to go to this place? It's kind of spooky. There's this music and these colorful windows. And I remember the smell of, you know, the frankincense and myrrh and all that. And he said, well, you know, you've been very blessed. And we're very blessed. So we take an hour each week to thank God for our blessings. And you think about all the hours in the week, one is not that much. And that always resonated with me, a reminder that, you know, you are called to something greater than yourself, that you should be humbled by the gifts you've received and what has been the blessings that have been bestowed upon you. So faith always helped me out, especially in the beginning through the grieving process. And for a while, it was always a sort of nice reservoir of strength when needed, without doubt. And as I traveled the world, I became very interested in learning about other religions, aside from Christianity and Catholicism and Judaism and Islam and Hinduism and Buddhism, and kind of picking up bits and pieces along the way of what made those religions tick. And you kind of walk away with a general feeling of that we're all trying to get to the same place. We're all trying to get to that place of peace and understanding. You just take different roads to get there, but there's so many similarities along the way. I mean, one of the things I write in the book is the similarity between Buddhism and the Jesuit examining meditation ritual that I used to do at Boston College all the time that was put on us by the Jesuits. But essentially, I travel around the world. I go to 70 plus countries, and I start writing the book, and I realize there's something eating away at me. And what's eating away at me is that I've not gone to the Holy Land. And interestingly enough, my father and mother had never been there either. And I come to realize, you know, this is something I really need to do. Maybe it'll give me a sort of sense of finality, but maybe it's just, maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's just something that I have to do just to feel and to just, you know, see my faith play out. And I go to the Holy Land. I spend almost 2 months in the Middle East going around all these different countries, but end up in Israel. It's so wild to go and see these locations that you learn about at Sunday school suddenly become alive. Like, oh my gosh, here's Jericho. Here's Bethlehem. Here's the Mount of Temptation. And here's where Simon picks up the cross, right? So all these things sort of come into view. And there's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is where Christ is buried, or the tomb of Christ, rather, we should say. And I decided, you know, I'm going to go in there because I wasn't planning on going that evening, but the line was short. I walked by and I knew enough to know that if the line was short, you go get in the line because the line could be hours. So I said, all right, I'm going to go to that line. And I go into the tomb of Christ and I have this very powerful spiritual moment. And essentially at that time, I so desire to have an answer of sort of why me? Why do I live? Why has this life been bestowed upon me? What am I supposed to do? What is my purpose? What is the meaning behind all this? What is the meaning behind me? And am I doing it right? Am I good enough? Is this okay? And this voice sort of goes off in the head. It's like, well, you know, he heard you, you know, go forth, you know, just be perceptive. And it was chilling because it's like, well, that's not the answer, right? But then that's the sort of mystery of faith. And yeah, I won't give away the conclusion of the book, but it's sort of that spurs what becomes the ending, which is a real self-evaluation, which is ultimately how faith works. And I come to a moment of real clarity, which sort of centralizes upon one thing that I think is really the message I hope to impart upon people, which is that, you know, we all miss our lost loved ones, but I think given the opportunity to speak with them, if they were to come back and have a coffee with us, I think most of them would say, when you think of me, smile, don't cry, and don't allow my passing to make your life miserable or make your life filled with sadness and grief. You know, we had a wonderful run, continue it. And it's not easy because you're not inclined to do that. You're more inclined to be so sad about all the things that you've missed and all the things that you hoped would have happened. But when you get to that place of saying, you know, wow, I'm just so grateful for the time that I had and my dad's looking out for me, it's very powerful.
As you said, there's more at the end of the book, but I encourage our listeners to buy the book and read it, this book in its totality. It's very meaningful and it's very well written and well done. I'm going to close on one question. I'm going to go back to something else that you kind of followed in your dad's tracks here. And I think it's something more journalists need to do, especially after the 16 election journalists came from the coast. We felt like lab rats here, you know, everybody. You go into dive bars, talk to average people. You did this around the world. I love that idea. And as a fellow person that likes dive bars, what did you find? I mean, among people around the globe, I guess, that makes us all kind of unique.
I love that question, Robin. And it's the first time it's ever been asked to me. So thank you for asking that. And, you know, this is something I learned from my father. Because he loved dive bars. My grandfather grew up going to the American Legion post in South Buffalo. And that's really where you get to know people. You put down your phone screens and you get to chat. And it's friendly, especially in the Midwest where you are. People are incredibly friendly. I'm fortunate enough to have been to 49 of the 50 states. The only one missing is North Dakota. So I have to go to North Dakota. And I like to think that I've been to a dive bar in most every state and chatted people up. But the things you learn in America, you know, they're very similar around the world, no matter the culture. And I boil it down to a few things. I think most folks want a roof over their head. They want food in their belly. They want a general sense of opportunity for themselves and for their children. And they like to think that they're not being, you know, taken advantage of, or they're at least getting a fair of enough deal. They know there's always things that are going to be out of their control, or there's things that are not right, but at least give me a chance here, right? And I think that's the sort of connective tissue that you see, is that this desire to have the bare necessities and to have an opportunity. And it's not, you know, that complicated, to be honest with you. And the one thing I truly believe, and, you know, I'll have, you know, some of my colleagues, you know, I would say coastal journalists will snicker at this, but I truly believe that we in the United States and really around the world probably align on about 70% of things. I mean, it's amazing how many things just sort of people go, if you just talk through it, it's like, yeah, okay, I agree. I might switch this up. I might switch that up. But there's only about 30% of people that are truly extreme. And I think 70% are there. And it's just talking through those things and getting to a place of not denigrating anyone who has the slightest difference of opinion than you. You know, one of the things that I'm very proud of my dad for is he was always able to maintain a real sense of civility. And I think for him, that was just a real true love of the American experiment, the American democracy, and how it was really built upon debate from the beginning, from the founding fathers and the Constitutional Convention, and how that's always played out. And we don't always get it right, but we're always trying. And yeah, that's something that I really do feel is lost now. There's so much woe is me. And respectfully, I mean, if you compare us to the other great superpowers, we're pretty good and we're pretty accepting of a lot of things that have not been for quite a while. So I'm happy you asked that question, because I really do think that for all the differences that we hear about, there is way more commonality than we think.
Luke Russert's been our guest today on Heartland Politics. He's the author of Look For Me There, Grieving My Father, Finding Myself. Luke is currently host of MSNBC Live, correct?
I host live events for MSNBC, and I never thought I'd get back into media, but they called me up and they said, we don't want you necessarily to do anything on air all the time, but we want you, you know, we saw what you did on your book tour and you spoke to people, and we want to talk about solutions and sort of solutions-based conversations. So that's what we're doing. We're putting together these programs where we're talking to different policy leaders and thought leaders, faith leaders, activists, people in the celebrity space around the country, sort of trying to figure out, all right, there is a magnitude of issues we have. What are some of the solutions we can come up with to fix them? And I think it's interesting because, you know, once you kind of get out of the hyperpartisan politics, there's a lot of really good ideas out there that have a lot of bipartisan buy-in. And it's just separating the extremes from really where people live. You know, I think one thing I talk about in the book, we have such a tendency, especially you see this in the media, to make everything black and white. The world's really in the gray. Everything's in the gray. And it's just figuring out that nuance and explaining that nuance. And it goes a long way.
Words of wisdom. Thank you for that. And I agree 100% with your comments there. Okay, so Luke's been our guest, and thanks, Luke. And I hope to have you back at some point to talk a little more politics.
I enjoyed our conversation. It was very nice. And that point about lab rats and the safaris to the Quad Cities, it's good of you to say that, because I think that needs to be put out there more. There's more attention needs to be paid year-round.
Well, thanks again, Luke, for being on, and thank you for writing this book.
Absolutely. Take care, Rob.
Listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.